Subcommittee on Senate Committee on Health and Human Services here today, and we have several bills that we're going to briefly introduce in order to keep them alive, and we will not be taking any testimony on those. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 699. Administration introduce the bill.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 699 includes, it's to include partial dental technology in the dentures, local taxes, and it makes related changes.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 699 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 772. Staff introduce the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 772 modifies requirements for certain health insurers to pay insured for dental services included in practice of denture technology, and it allows payments of total uninsured balance with maximum annual limit for the previous 5 years, once every 5 years, and it's allowing certain restrictions.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 772 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 962.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 962 is clarifying the working relationship between the Oregon Board of Dentistry and the dentorum.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 962 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 941.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 941 is requesting to create a residential treatment program and outpatient treatment program for individuals with dual diagnosis of mental health and substance use disorders. It directs Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division to adopt rules. It creates a Mental Health Advisory Committee on Dual Diagnosis Residential Treatment. It is appropriating money from the General Fund to the Division to establish these treatment programs. Sunsets in on December 31, the year 2001, and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 941, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill TCAM. Nancy Ellison, Peggy Ann.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nancy Ellison, the administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division. With me is Maxine McKibben, the assistant manager of our Rates and Forms unit. Thank you very much for making time to hear Senate Bill 210. The assistant asked me to explain a little bit the background of this bill because it's not self-explanatory. If you had a chance to read it, you probably thought it was a series of somewhat unconnected changes to the insurance code, and basically that is what it is. What Senate Bill 210 does is put some final touches on legislation that was passed in 1997 that conformed Oregon insurance law to changes in the federal law under the HIPAA bill, which was known as the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill while it was making its way through Congress. That bill was passed to ensure that people won't lose health coverage when they leave a job and won't be disadvantaged in their new coverage when they regain employment. In the previous session of the legislature, we offered and you adopted Senate Bill 98, which made most of the conforming changes that we needed to make. In the intervening 2 years, HICPA has promulgated some rules to further implement this legislation, and our Senate Bill 210 is intended to help us conform with those rules that have been promulgated. I'd like to give just a couple of brief examples of the changes. One is found in our proposed changes to statutes governing the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is a state program for providing health insurance to individuals who are unable to otherwise qualify. And those statutes already allow certain individuals to qualify for portability health coverage. So we're proposing that an individual who leaves coverage under a group or portability plan should be able to obtain it through OMIP when the carrier formally insuring the individual can't afford can't offer a portability plan because they've left the area or withdrawn from the market. Another example is that prior coverage of an individual under a publicly sponsored or subsidized health plan, such as that provided by the Oregon Health Plan, would be counted for the purpose of enabling a person to move to other group health coverage. And another example would be that our current law, which requires insurers to offer a client service plan to employers with 25 or more employees, would be amended to apply the requirement to employers with 2 to 50 employees, because that's what the federal law defines a small group as. We've also suggested adopting enforcement of the Federal Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act of 1998 in this bill. Most of the other changes are technical, but they're all to just conform Oregon law with either the HIPAA statute or other federal statutes, and to allow the state to stay in control of its own destiny as far as the regulation of insurance goes, rather than having HIPAA come in and try to do it. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I always like it when people look at these technical conforming bills to the insurance code, because everybody's eyes automatically glaze over, and the series of amendments that you see is actually glazed over the eyes of the people who work in this on a day-to-day basis. What has happened is this bill has actually evolved through a committee process, and there has been subsequent work that was necessary, because in reviewing the provisions, we realized that in some regards the bill had gone before or gone beyond what we had considered to be necessary technical and HIPAA conforming requirements. So I have an additional set of amendments that actually take some of the language back to current statute, as was enacted related to the Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee. Discussed these with the department, and they are comfortable with these, and I think that with those kinds of changes, I would be comfortable with the bill, and I believe also that Regents has some additional technical clarifications that they are going to present as additional conceptual amendments.
We have a Phase 2 amendment and a Phase 3 amendment here. Package that you sent, Bill 210, are these the amendments you refer to, or one in particular amendment you refer to?
Mr. Chair, I believe the Dash 2 amendments are the department's amendments. The Dash 3 amendments are my amendments, and then I think that the Regents have some amendments that they will propose as conceptual amendments, although these have been reviewed by the department, as I understand it, and they are also comfortable with those amendments.
All right. I'm going to convene the full committee at this time. We have enough members to do that. Thank you. And we'll continue on with the public hearing on Senate Bill 210. Questions by the committee? I would ask, you'll have a question. Why the deletions of lines 26 and 27 on page 1, or excuse me, page 17? Toll-free telephone number.
Senator Fisher and members of the committee, the toll-free telephone number that's referred to in there was a number to provide information about the small group reforms of several years ago. And we found that 70% of the calls we were receiving were not only not about small group health insurance, they were not about insurance at all. They were other unrelated calls, unrelated to our agency, and the remainder were about other insurance questions. So the information was not getting to the people that it was designed for. Most of those folks were calling the OMIP program instead to get information about the small group reform. We would like to, at some future time, institute a broad spectrum 800 number for folks around the state, but this particular one was not serving its purpose.
Barbara Reese from OMIT.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Reese, and I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And we would just like to lend our support with Senate Bill 210 as it's been proposed with the amendments. We have reviewed those, and we do feel that they are, they do put the bill in form that is just a technical fix to what we're already doing. So we wanted to lend our support to that.
Does your support include the conceptual amendments that we haven't heard about yet?
We have seen those amendments, and yes, we do support them.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bruce Fisher from John Hall. By the way, I apologize, Peggy and John. I was in the process of waiting. Yeah, well, my reflexes weren't quick enough to stop it. So.
At least you didn't use our heads as the block, and we appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross and Shield of Oregon, and I'm here before you today really as a messenger, and if there are technical questions, I'll ask the department to come up because I am relaying a conceptual amendment that was agreed to between a lawyer for Regents in Portland and the department, and they worked that out without me being on the line. And so I'm going to show you where those amendments would appear and tell you that they are not substantive in nature, but only clarifying in nature. So they try to clarify the language. And if the best way to do it is to look at the department's -2 amendments, and they would appear on in 3 places in those amendments, beginning on page 2 on line 26, where it says on page 14, on the next line, after the first word discontinued, you would add in a specified service area, and then the sentence would continue. And then in line 28, after the word provided, you would insert in that service area. So you can see these are technical in nature and do not change the meaning of the paragraph that are meant to clarify it. That same amendment then would occur on page 4 of the amendment on lines 25 and 26, and on page 5 of the amendment on line, beginning on line 12. It would be the same amendment, Mr. Chairman. And again, it is only clarifying the intent of the paragraph and not changing the meaning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I'm representing Kaiser Permanente. I've distributed to the committee copies of written comments with 2 suggestions for additional changes to Senate Bill 210. We have discussed these proposed changes with the insurance division, and I believe they're comfortable with the suggestions, and I'm sure that they can incorporate them into other amendments that would be before the committee. Just briefly, the 2 changes would expand the provision that's in current law that allows for termination of an enrollee who misuses the provider network provision. And our language would propose to explain that that authority can be exercised when there's a client who's abusive or disruptive in a clinical setting, and there's no ability to provide care for that person, that we would be able to terminate that enrollee membership.
Would that be out of a group policy, for instance, or?
It could be out of either a group or an individual policy, and it's a particular problem for Kaiser Permanente where we have our own clinics, medical offices, dental offices, and in the very rare situation in which a client is unwilling to go along or is actually abusive to staff, we would like to retain the authority under law to be able to terminate that enrollment.
give us the legal process by which this would actually be done? Is it just a summary thing, or is there a process in effect now where the person would have a right to a hearing? Or?
Mr. Chair, under Kaiser Permanente Service Agreement, the person would have a right to a grievance to go through those processes, and in addition, we would give 31 days advance written notice to the person. So that action would only be taken in very extreme situations, but it is one that we think is appropriate for those rare situations where a person is disrupted, you know, for either his or her own care or somebody else's care in the clinic.
And that would be a program like that, or this type of a thing would be on file or under the DCBS rules?
That's correct. The second change is even more technical. The bill proposes to repeal ORS 653.300, which is a requirement that's been in the law for about 14 years that allows an HMO to request that an employer offer that HMO's coverage. While that provision probably has limited applicability because of federal law, we think there are some situations in which having the provision in state law may be beneficial, and we would recommend that that section not be repealed to accomplish that, taking 653.300 out from page 32, line 4 of the bill, is all that would be needed. We have identified in our testimony the two specific changes that we would recommend further to Senate Bill 210, and with those changes to support the bill and its passage. Well, if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Questions, ready?
I'm sorry I was late and didn't get the very beginning of your presentation. Thank you for the information you provided. I was curious about, is this testimony that was submitted by Nancy Ellison, have we heard from her yet?
Yes, and their agreement was, as I understand it, with the proposed conceptual amendments also.
Okay.
And they have provided the Stage 2 amendments from the DCCBS, and those are agreeable to the industry, apparently, and others. And the 210-3 were from the health insurance industry, and they're agreeable with them, and also DCCBS is agreeable with them. And the conceptual amendments here, what I want to make certain is that both Mr. Powell's and Mr. Bishop's conceptual amendments here were what was addressed by DCBS,
mm-hmm.
and that they have seen both of these and agree with both of these gentlemen's conceptual amendments here. So if we can do that, we can probably have staff make sure that these get drawn up right away. And bring this bill back and deal with it summarily and deal on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nancy, did you wish to just reiterate for the record perhaps that these two different mentions of conceptual amendments here, what you do?
Mr. Chair, I'll be glad to. Yes, the division is comfortable with Mr. Powell's amendments as simply a clarifying change, and we're also comfortable with Mr. Bishop's language as well.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions on this bill from the committee? Hearing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 210 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 880. Lee Hazelwood and Leo Profita. I apologize, Leo. I have to remember that. Since we both serve on the Government Commission on Senior Services here,
Well, Senator, with a name like Fafitas, I answer to almost anything since grade school. And I want to apologize to you, Senator Fisher, for misspelling your name. I started this process, and once it's in a computer, it never comes out, it seems, because I tried to get it out, but it didn't come out. Anyway, Senator Fisher and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. My name is Leo Fafitas. I'm chair of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, Mental Health, and Alcohol and Drug Committee. Before I retired, I was a mental health specialist in Clackamas County. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 880 on behalf of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I would like to briefly explain about the Senior Mental Health Project and the need for more specialized services for Oregon seniors. In 1989, the Oregon Legislature awarded Senior and Disabled Services Division a supplemental appropriation of $200,000 to support the mental health needs of the elderly. Those dollars resulted in six senior mental health projects, mostly in the Willamette Valley, and one in eastern Oregon. The above-mentioned projects have been successful in not only reaching seniors with emotional, alcohol, and drug problems, including prescriptions and over-the-counter drugs, but in generating significant matching funds. Since 1989, the legislature and SDSD have provided the senior mental health projects with $900,000. The projects have been able to generate an additional $2.5 million through matching funds. From 1989 through 1998, these projects have served almost 5,000 people with counseling services, outreach workers, and volunteers. Over 5,000 more professional and paraprofessional service providers, advocates, and family members have received training and education on mental health and alcohol and drug problems, and how to deal with those problems. There was a random sampling of services in the five current projects. This had been asked for this last year. Each project reviewed 20 persons for a total of 100 people for a one-year period. It was determined that these projects were able to save the state money by preventing more serious complications and treatment needs. In fact, the cost savings for one-year time period to the state because of services provided by these projects were approximately $205,000. That's about $41,000 per project. This shows a considerable savings to the state when it is considered that in each one of these projects that is allocated a little over $16,000 per project per year. It is estimated that the cost of not serving these 100 people would have been approximately $12,000 per person for hospital and nursing care facilities. That's $1,200,000 for those 100 people. Please let me explain the nature of the problem. National studies show that 15 to 25% of adults over age 65 suffer from clinical depression or other forms of mental illness. Alcohol abuse seems to afflict approximately 10% of the population over 65. While Medicare allows unlimited number of visits to the hospital ER for alcohol detox, it does not allow one penny, to my knowledge, for treatment. Each use of the hospital ER costs approximately $5,000, and this has been determined by national studies. The figure does not include intensive care, hospital bed, or needed nursing home facilities. In one case that I'm familiar with, a person was in the ER over 12 times in 18 months because of alcohol abuse. This was an elder over age 65. This does not include the many times that that same person was in intensive care, hospital bed, and nursing home for health rehabilitation. In another case, the person, another elder, would binge, pass out, many times go into a coma. Twice this person's heart had stopped, and she was resuscitated by the emergency medical technicians. In the first case, the person had an alcohol-related dementia as a result of this abuse and or alcoholism. It was subsequently, and she was subsequently committed by the courts and then placed in a locked care facility. In the second case, the person had numerous health problems and life losses leading to serious depression, which she attempted to alleviate by alcohol. In both cases, the family and neighbors didn't know where to turn until they were able to find a senior mental health program. Suicide is often the result of depression and alcohol abuse. Elder suicides rank the highest of any age group. Second highest is adolescence. Indeed, there are many similarities in mental health issues and treatment of elders and children. Both suffer from high rates of depression, suicide, and attempted suicide. And need I say more about that after what happened in Littleton, Colorado yesterday? Both groups lack empowerment of resources. Both groups do not know where to turn for help. The families of elders and adolescents do not know where to turn for resources. Much has been said in this day and age about services needed for children, but little is being said about services for elders. The legislature and SDSU have made a wise investment in senior mental health projects. Now we would like you to make another cost-saving investment. We ask you to fund another 5 projects to serve our coastal and rural communities with an ever-expanding older and diverse citizenry. I would leave you with a closing thought. A recent report by Oregon's Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs showed that 35,618 clients received services for alcohol and drug problems in the state of Oregon from July 1, 1997 to June 30, 1998. Only 151 were seniors. And of the 151 statewide, 94 were from project areas receiving services. There were only 25 minority elders serviced statewide. We need your help and support. More importantly, seniors all across the state need your help to recover their mental health and their quality of life. Thank you, and I'll be glad to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Lewis. I might say that the Fisher family dropped the C out of their name at a time when we didn't have computers. It wasn't a real great problem then.
Well, I have 5 AKAs to my last name, spelling, sir.
Go ahead, Lee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I'm legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission. I do want to point out back in 1989, in the late hours of the session, or I should say probably early morning hours of the session, we were able to get $200,000 for mental health, and Senator Casula wants you to understand that one of my insisted on being in Lane County at that time. I did have a little bit of control at that time. But I also then, since I was part of getting that money, that I did join the Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency first mental health pilot project. It was called Caring Friends. Each one of us was given an older person to work with, call on them, do grocery shopping or something. So I was part of that early program. So I do urge your support for Senate Bill 880. And since Leo brought it up, I do want to say out loud that my daughter-in-law is a teacher at Columbine School in Littleton, Colorado, and heard from her late last night, and thankfully she's okay. But thank you. We need your support for Senate Bill 880 because it is a crucial program in the state of Oregon.
All right, thank you. We have Jim Davis, United Seniors, Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens. Provided us with some written testimony here.
Yes, actually. Senator Fisher, members of the committee, I won't take much of your time. I'm Jim Davis, representing State Council of Seniors and United Seniors and the Great Panthers, but also as a social psychologist and gerontologist, I've been involved with these projects since their inception, and actually helped start them way back when, and have helped coordinate them since. And I don't have a lot to add to the testimony of Leo and Lee, except the fact that these projects have had a significant impact in our local communities. And for a very small price tag, that we've been able to match that money 2.5 to 1. We have reached thousands of seniors with these services. And the study that you see in front of you, what you'll see, what has been handed out, there are project summaries that have the data on each of the projects in terms of how many clients that they served and what their matching funds were. So that is in front of you. Also, you have the recent study that was conducted through SDSD, and that study is so significant in that, as Leo had said, we tested 100 clients who had been involved with these projects. And I understand there's been 4,800 clients that have been involved with these projects, and that each of those clients, if they had gone unserved, would have cost around $12,500. And that was the average of $230,000 per project. If you times that by the number of clients that have been served by these projects, what you will see is that we have been able, through these projects, to save the state tens of millions of dollars that would have been spent trying to deal with the problem, their emotional as well as alcohol and drug problems. And currently, without special projects like this, both in private and public sectors, there is very little response to the mental health and alcohol and drug abuse needs of our senior population. It is actually startling when you look at the statistics of how they're ignored in these systems. So what we are asking today is simply for you to support our bill and send it to Ways and Means, where we will be attempting to convince those good people on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Resources to provide additional funding for these projects, which would expand the funding that is already going to the 5 current projects, but would also start, as Leah said and Leo, projects on the coast in central Oregon and eastern Oregon, where there are high senior populations and they're simply not being reached with these services. We have not, our total amount of funding now is the same as it was in 1989. We have not received any increase during this decade. It's actually gone down, and we've kind of climbed back up, but we have received absolutely no increase, and so we're asking a decade later, with the success we've had with these projects, to get a small increase and be able to reach more seniors with it.
You have an actual number. I see that it would expand the projects that we have already underway and also would develop new projects. The original apparently was 5 pilot projects, and I don't see any particular number here. It just is.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, if I might respond to that. Actually, we started with 6 projects. Multnomah County had a very successful project, but they opted out, so now we have 5. What would happen is the current projects are receiving around $32,000 per biennium. That would go up to $60,000 per biennium, or $30,000 per year for the current projects. Then 5 new projects would be added at $60,000 per project. And then there would be, I believe, around $50,000 for administration, training, and those items for a total budget of $650,000. But already in the SDSD budget is $200,000. This $450,000 would be added to that.
Where do you see the 5? I've been looking through this and I have a hard time here finding the word 5.
Well, there are currently, on some of the data, Senator, what you're seeing is we're recounting to you the accomplishments of Multnomah County, which brings it to 6. But as I say, they currently do not have a project.
It alludes to the fact that there need to be 5. It just says more.
Yeah. Well, we would expand the 5 current projects, and then we would add 5 new projects. If we receive the full funding in areas where they're not currently served.
there's further questions.
Thank you very much.
Close public hearing and first ask if anyone else is wishing to testify. Close the work session on public hearing on Senate Bill 880 and open work session on Senate Bill 880.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this has a prior reference to raising
yes.
You're removing the amendment. I'll move Senate Bill 880 to the floor with a dispatch recommendation.
No, I'm raising
it. I just heard that, yeah.
Senator, the recommended dispatch. Senator Duncan moves the Senate Bill 880 to the Ways and Means Committee with a dispatch recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, clerk call
aye.
Senator
Field?
Aye.
Senator
Steele?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. We will send Senate Bill 880 to the Ways and Means Committee. Close the work station on Senate Bill 880 and open a public hearing on SJM 11. Let me introduce that while we ask.
Chair, members of the committee, SJM 11 is urging Congress to allow Oregon to implement a pilot food stamp project.
I'm not sure the first name here, but we have Sandy Hoback and Ellen Lowe. And this John Hilmer? Okay. Go ahead and come forward and if it is possible and begin testimony in any order that you prefer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John L. Hildner, resident of Plaquemines County, and vice chair of the Child Health Cluster of the Oregon Option. And the reason I'm here this morning with these two distinguished colleagues is that the Oregon Option Child Health Cluster has been working for about 8 months with both the advocacy community and with Adult and Family Services to look at how we can make a change and do what is intended by both this bill and by Senate Bill 1280. Our concern is that we need to have Oregonians together in terms of the kinds of changes that we need to make to the food stamp program in the state of Oregon that would both make it easier for the department to administer it, that would make lives of people in this state better, and that we could use the principles of the Oregon Option that would allow for improvements made to not cost us money when it comes to the federal government. All too often we get rewarded by success by a decrease in funding. So we would urge, and I will not speak for both of these folks, but we would urge on the part of the stakeholders committee that has been working for 8 months and is continuing to hold hearings around the state, we would urge that both these bills be tabled at this point. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Sandy Hoback, Administrator of Adult and Family Services, and John is correct. We've been working on this issue for a little over a year now, and we did put forward a concept very similar to what is in this legislation to the Department of Agriculture, who administers the food stamp program, and they essentially were not interested in the concept as it was presented, and then that kind of prompted us to do a much broader process involving advocates and other stakeholders in this process, and that's the process was undertaken, and I'm very satisfied that that process is moving us ahead in an appropriate and a good way. From my perspective, this legislation is not necessary for us to continue down that road. We certainly have the authority to go after waivers and would do so at the point at which that was appropriate. At the same time, I want to be clear, and if the chair or the committee administrator reads this differently than I do, that were this legislation to pass, either the Senate Joint Memorial or Senate Bill 1280, I don't read anything in the legislation that jeopardizes our process that we've undertaken, and I want to continue to honor my commitment as an agency administrator to the citizen input process, and I would want that to continue regardless of the passage of this legislation. I don't see anything in there that would prevent us from that, so I just want to be certain and on the record that I'm clear about my intentions in that, and that I would want that process to continue, because we do want very broad-based input. We want to hear all the points of view. The food stamp program is a very critical program to low-income Oregonians. It amounts to close to $500 million that flows through the state each biennium in that nutrition benefit. So clearly it's a critical benefit. It's something that we don't want to take lightly or to rush into in terms of major changes. At the same time, I think we would all agree at the table that there really are some fundamental problems that don't work well from a consumer standpoint, especially for the working poor in the food stamp program, and that's what we're trying to tackle together. So,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I serve as chair of the Hunger Relief Task Force, which was created by one of your predecessor bodies. I believe the year was 1989. I would like to follow up on Jono's request that these two pieces of legislation be tabled. We believe they're premature, and we believe that their existence, if they were passed, would create barriers to the listening process that is now underway. There will be focus groups, there will be forums across the state in May, and we really want a process that's open so that we can listen without any barriers as we ask folks what they wish to have happen to improve the food stamp program. The food stamp program is the number one nutritional safety net in the state of Oregon. We know there are things that can be done to make it work better for those in Oregon who are hungry. And the purpose of these meetings is really to listen, and then hopefully those of us who are involved in the stakeholders committee, and we have a commitment to expand that, will do the kind of discerning which will allow Oregon to make improvements in this system, so that someday we really can say that no one in Oregon is going to go hungry. And so again, we ask that you set these bills aside so that we might have some time in a very open process to hear from those who are out in the food pantry, working with people who are hungry, and to listen to those who are under 130% of the poverty level and are eligible for food stamps in this state. Thank you.
Nobody has really, outlined what they consider the problem to be. What is SJLM law that stop you from doing? How does it inhibit your process of making sure that everyone has
Mr. Chair, I've discovered in a number of areas in which I'm involved with citizens that sometimes when you go out with the prescription before you've done the diagnosis, that you do create barriers to their coming forward and openly participating, because they see it as saying that you've already made up your mind what the remedy needs to be. And so they indeed may be coming up with additional remedies. And I'll give an example really out of the not-for-profit part of the response to hunger, in that a great many food pantries are now doing recruitment of volunteers among folks who work during the day but have some time in the evenings or on Saturdays. In other words, not my generation, but a younger generation. And as a result, you see them having their hours when the working poor are able to come, maybe evenings, maybe weekends. And so one of the things, for example, that I've heard about food stamps is that one of the barriers may be the hours. And so, but you need to be out there listening to folks to find out, first of all, we aren't serving everybody who's eligible for food stamps. And we need to try to find out why. What is it that's keeping them from availing themselves of this nutritional safety net? And then the other thing is that we need to spend some time looking at what are federal rules and regs, and to see some of those are optional. And so maybe we have the power already to respond in a different way. But for those of us in the Hunger Relief Task Force, we have tried to say in our outreach to folks across the state that there's still an open plate. There is still a screen where they are going to be able to design some of the picture. And we feel that these particular pieces of legislation give them the impression that we've already made up our mind.
Yes, Senator Christina.
Thank you. I have no doubt that changes are probably needed in our food stamp program. I'm just wondering, I just was alerted last night. I got an email here at 5:45 last night alerting me that there's a research project underway at the Center for the Study of Women in Society at the University of Oregon, and that they're going to be doing an ongoing study of how clients who left the food stamp and TANF in the first quarter of 98 are faring, and but that information is probably not going to be ready for us during this session. I guess it will happen later on this year. So it seems like we do have a study that's underway that is trying to help gather some information to help with understanding perhaps what changes need to be made, or making some recommendations for all of us. And I don't know that we lose anything by not moving forward on these, because as we just heard Sandy say, they can still do some of this stuff even without these. I think, and I know that Ellen is out there in the trenches and hearing from folks about what we should be doing on this issue. So I think, you know, maybe we do need to wait and get a little bit more information before we go forward. But thanks to hear from anybody else who has ideas about this.
Thank you. I'll public hearing on Senate Bill JM-11 and open a public hearing on SB 1280. And I think Wolf said you can stay right up here. Look like the lead off people on the Senate Bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think our remarks are going to be almost exactly the same, and we should not take up your time because these two bills just deal with two different aspects of exactly the same issue.
Okay. go for all three of them?
All right.
We have further than Roy Freeman, Patty Whitney, and Rich Peppers.
Thank you. I'm Patty Whitney Wise. I'm the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force and have been participating in the food stamp stakeholders group for the last 8 months and working with Adult and Family Services with concerns that we've had for their proposals for over a year now. I just want to reiterate our major concerns with moving forward on either the memorial or the bill at this point in time is that it will be perceived by many in the community as a done deal. It is basically the same proposal that was put out a year ago, and when AFS held some public hearings around the state, there were some very major concerns raised, which is what led to the forming of the stakeholder group to try to begin to work out some of those differences to see if we could come together and come up with some common ways of moving forward so we were united rather than fighting with each other. And I do believe that that process is beginning to culminate in some very good things. There have been some things the task force has done jointly with AFS since those meetings started, including putting together a training series for nonprofits, doing some work with able-bodied adults without dependents on behalf of the department. And I want to really honor those commitments and continue to build. I really do feel that these two pieces of legislation would throw a wrench into that process for many people in the local community whose trust is just being built in this process of input. So I would add my voice to those who have urged that you table these for now. The department is very able to move forward without them. They can still apply for waivers without state legislation. So basically, the two measures are unnecessary at this time. They still have the ability to move forward, and we would like for this process to be a very open process. Thank you very much.
Why are the stakeholder members basically excluding any of the folks that were interested in these two particular bills?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Could you?
Well, I have a list here of the stakeholders provided in some of the testimony letter, April 20, 1999, here from the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force.
Yes.
And I see absolutely no one from the folks who have an interest in the SJM 11 and Senate Bill 1280 involved whatsoever in the stakeholders
process. This was a startup group that was of people who were very keenly interested and tried to take a cross-representation. There was business community representation requested. The person was not able to attend. We are, as of these public hearings in May, opening up the stakeholder group to anyone who is interested in participating. That was our agreement at our last stakeholder meeting. The reason we didn't open it up further before then is we were trying to build a level of trust and common ground amongst people who, quite frankly, had some very major differences in the past. So we were trying to, if we continue to add new people, it would mean sort of going back again and trying to build that trust each time we had a meeting. So it's been a fairly delicate process. I think there's been some very good progress, and we would certainly welcome anyone to the table at this point in this process, and those are the intentions of the group. I believe it states so in the fact sheet that is attached there as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm a staff attorney with the Oregon Law Center. We're a nonprofit law firm representing low-income Oregonians statewide in civil matters. I personally have my area of expertise in public benefits and have focused on public benefits law for in Oregon for the past 16 years. I'm here in opposition to Senate SJM 11 and Senate Bill 1280. As both Ms. Hoback and Ms. Whitney Wise have testified, about a year ago, the first waiver request was submitted to the USDA by the Adult and Family Services Division. There was hue and cry from every corner of the state, from advocates, social service providers, food bank folks. There were many, many concerns. And as a result, AFS did already last year hold some public hearings, and I attended a couple of them. I just want to show you, these are the notes that were drawn up by AFS from just one of those public hearings. You can see it's single spaced, 2.5 pages long, concerns from people about this same proposal, which is embodied in these bills before you today. And that's why it's so very important that the public process go forward, because none of these concerns from this forum or from the other forum have been incorporated into the proposal. And we think it's very, very important that they be addressed. And it's for that reason that we oppose Senate Bill 1280 and SJM 11. Thank you.
Yes. And you, ladies first.
Oh.
I didn't.
Well, thank you.
Alphabetically.
I was just wondering, the concept of getting the block grant so that we could be more flexible in how we use those dollars, if it looks like we could use them in a more effective way, or stretch the dollars further to serve more people, or, you know, it seems like there are merits to wanting to explore having more flexibility on how federal dollars are used. So you're not saying that you're against, or are you against us pursuing just being able to have more flexibility with those dollars?
We are opposed to a block grant structure, and the reason is that it creates a fiscal incentive to reduce caseloads at any cost. It also creates a fiscal disincentive to do the outreach, which is sorely needed. As Ms. Lowe testified, we're not serving all of the food stamp eligibles that we could be serving. And I know at an earlier, another committee, Senator Tro had requested additional money for outreach. We've been pressing the agency to do outreach, and they've declined to do that. So if you have a block grant, it creates an incentive to reduce caseloads and not to do the outreach that really needs to be done.
The other part of a block grant is that if we have an economic downturn in Oregon, there is no flexibility in meeting the increased need in an economic downturn. The department has tried to work out the language, so it is not a block grant. Unfortunately, federal restrictions and the way they look at it still sort of earmarks it as a block grant. So we're trying to explore some different ways of doing that. We are far apart on that issue at this point, but we are working to try to come to some common ground on that point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can I ask
yes.
one more? Thank you. Would you agree that changes, that the program, I mean, that we do need changes to make it work better for folks?
Yes, definitely. And I mentioned the work with the nonprofit trainings and the able-bodied adults as two examples where we are trying to work with the department on some changes. We believe there are changes that need to be made at the local, state, and federal level, that there's really all three levels that need work. And we want to make sure that we're doing that work that we can in Oregon, maybe not before, but at least at the same time as we're going to the federal government for changes.
In fact, there are many things that can be done at this time that they could either get waiver approval for or do under the simplified program already provided for under federal law, and we're hoping that they would pursue that rather than urge Congress to amend the Food Stamp Act to allow them to do this.
Okay.
Senator Shields, you're the vice chair of this Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. You're supposed to be giving the answers, not questions.
I can give you lots of answers. One,
go ahead.
But I would ask Lori, in the 2.5 pages of notes there, obviously several specific concerns are raised, and the chair earlier was asking for some more specificity. I was wondering if you would like to maybe take a minute and just give us 4 or 5 things that might jump off that list about specific concerns that various people around the state may have raised. That's one part of my question, and the other is that one of the emails that I got on this issue is that food stamps now serve a lot of working poor, and there is a real case management problem if you have an AFF case manager working a regular job, 8 to 5 or whatever, and a poor person working 8 to 5, it's pretty hard to get case managed. I imagine that's one of the concerns, but have you had some direct experience with the impact of that, or have you had direct experience with people that are concerned about that case management factor?
Yes, that's a very serious concern because of the 8 to 5 hours, and in fact, in offices in District 2, which is Multnomah and Washington County, the way they have it set up is if you want to apply for food stamps, there's a first-come, first-served that you have to go and line up by 7:30 in the morning, and they will give out numbers, basically, or take your names until 8:30, and then you sit around all morning and wait to be seen by a food stamp intake worker.
That's no different. Electrical inspection.
You have to take a half day off.
Right, and you can see how difficult that is if you have a job where you work 8 to 5 and you don't get any vacation time. So because this would be aimed mostly at working families, because if they're not working, then they would presumably be eligible for the TANF program, that it doesn't make a lot of sense to do case management on these families, especially when there are many barriers that need to be addressed to just receiving services from Adult and Family Services. The other population is what we call the ABODs, the able-bodied dependents, able-bodied adults without dependents, and there's been a dramatic decline in those, in that caseload, just because of changes in federal law. And the agency has had a hard time spending the $3.6 million that's available already to serve this population. According to a GAO report, they were only able to spend about $600,000 of the money. There's $3 million setting out there that they haven't been able to spend for this population. So we'd like to get this program developed a little more, and we would like a little more guidance, both from the public and from other stakeholders, before this goes forward. Your question about some of the questions, for example, the first four is, why didn't AFS go with a pilot program first? Why weren't waivers submitted? Why were the waivers submitted prior to community input? These kinds of questions are the exact same things that Ellen Lowe and Ms. Whitney Wise raised, in that we need to build trust, we need to figure out what the problems are and then tackle them, not write the prescription before we have the diagnosis.
I'd like to just add that we really appreciate the committee's interest in these issues, and we do agree, I want to make sure that's clear, that there are changes that need to be made also at the federal level. But we'd like to do it together as a community and not just have one perspective in law when there are other perspectives that I think need to be honored as well. And together, I think that we'll have a much better proposal to take forward federally, one that does have buy-in and trust from local people in local communities as well.
I'd like you to consider some amendments. I intend to do some more work on these. We're pretty rushed for time today, and we've got another big issue to go into that I want to give a minimum of half hour to. And so I would consider ask you to consider consider very much looking into proposed amendments that might make these bills something that you could get together with, because I don't think that it hurts at all to give more than just an agency direction to the federal government, perhaps a little impetus from the House and Senate in full accord or basic accord on this issue would also lend some weight to that. And so I would like to pursue it, and Senator Shields and I have worked before together on issues where we both disagree with the way the federal government handled things. So I would like not to just have the matter drop to if there's not some way that we can't work together to get something that would be viewed, at least by both sides, as beneficial, and that we could then lend the weight of the legislature to the weight of the agency in the request for waivers or whatever process that they need to go through. So please, if you can direct some attention at it where specific things might be done to SB 11 and Senate Bill 1280 that would perhaps at least use them as vehicles to accomplish something that will help in the overall process. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, we had Rich Parker.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, for the record, Rich Peppers with the Oregon Public Employees Union. And since I see you're ready to move on, I'll just add a little tiny piece of information besides seconding some of the concerns you've already heard here. And that is that we had an opportunity, OPEU represents the frontline AFS caseworkers, and there was a meeting that had been scheduled already last weekend of leadership from around the state in our membership there, and they had an opportunity to review this legislation. And they raised a lot of these concerns that you've just been hearing about as well, about the legislation. So I wanted you to know that from a frontline worker perspective, there are those concerns as well.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1280 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1097. And ask Lane Bartle and Kurt Dagger to come up and let us introduce this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1097 creates the Commission for Fathers and Families. It's also creating a Commission for Fathers and Families account. It appropriates money from the general fund and the Department of Human Resources to be dispersed to the Commission, and any matching of supplemental state funds required for federal grants is declaring an emergency effective upon passage.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Lane Bartle. I am a director of the Oregon Men's Association and lead lobbyist. The purpose of Senate Bill 1097 is actually visitation enforcement. It's called Fathers and Families because 80 to 90% of all non-custodial parents are fathers. I want to make a couple of points about the bill. In 1987, the legislature made a promise to the children of the state that after their parents separated, either a divorce or just a separation, that the policy of the state is to assure these children a frequent and continuing contact with both their parents. And I submit to you that is practiced by bench and bar, and much of the state, that is a very empty promise. This will actually flesh out that promise and make it real. We're very knowledgeable, of course, and aware of the funding crunch in this session, particularly with the education budget. The way the bill is actually summarized is a bit of a misnomer. There should be no fiscal impact at all on the state. There is a visitation enforcement grant that comes from the federal government. The intent of this bill is to be fully funded by that federal grant. The only fiscal impact actually would be for the pay for two of the commission members who are legislators. The intent of the bill also, even though it's called Fathers and Families, is to serve all non-custodial parents. There are
mothers out there that have problems as severe as most of the fathers we see that aren't getting fair access to their children. What the bill does in a nutshell is basically serve non-custodial parents. It represents them to state commissions, to state agencies, and serves their interests there. Basically, when public policy and policy decisions are being made by the state, that affects them, that they do have a voice. Fathers and other non-custodial parents are a large resource to families, and it's a resource that is largely overlooked. What the bill would do is create 9 commission members. 2 apiece would be appointed by each of the head of the government, by the governor, by the president of the Senate, by the Speaker of the House, and by the Chief Justice, all heads of the government, and then a 9th member would be appointed by consensus of those heads of government. Even though money is appropriated from the Department of Human Resources, it's meant to equal that grant, which is in the tune of about $113,000 a year. The Dash 1 amendments that we asked for and it's just become available basically cleans up some of the language and makes clear what we hope is the intent of the bill. There's been some concerns expressed by the Department of Justice about child support enforcement. Discussed those with Ms. Schenkel. We have no problem with that. I don't see this commission asking the Department of Justice to reveal anything confidential about people or to really offer illegal advice about child support. This would be a matter for referral to the resources in the state, the people that are entrusted and paid for by the state to deal with child support problems. Hopefully there'll be some community resources by the time this commission is up and running. I do want to make one retraction. On page 2 of the testimony, you'll notice that the next to last paragraph has part of a sentence which is crossed out. The full sentence originally said, currently it is being used for other programs, none of which are directed exactly to visitation enforcement. I have no personal knowledge of that. It's been called to my attention that I am an error. Mr. Jagger knows a lot more than I do. We are not in the business of promoting rumors or gossip, so we'll let that come out as it may.
Okay, appreciate that, Wayne.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Kurt. Well, thank you, Chair Fisher, for allowing us the opportunity to have Senate Bill 1097 heard. For the record, my name is Kurt Jager. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1097. I've lived in Clackamas County most of the last 20 years. I've been a non-custodial parent in the past, and however, I currently have custody of my 2 minor children, Kaitlyn and Jager, 15. Andrew Logan Jager, 10 years old, and I have had custody of him for some time. For approximately the last 7 years, I've been active as a non-custodial parents advocate. I've been trained by MethoCrisis as a crisis intervention counselor. I have produced many hours of cable access television program devoted to the topic. Spent thousands of hours of volunteer time and thousands of dollars of my own money in order to call attention to our cause here. I don't even get my travel expenses reimbursed for being here today or for much of anything that I do for our cause. I'm currently the director for both the Oregon Coalition for Family Law Reform and the Oregon Coalition for Family Rights, as well as a member of the Citizens Advisory Board for the Parental Access and Visitation Establishment Project in Douglas County, Oregon. I'm here today mostly to speak about the PAVE program down there, since we are wanting to defund that project in order to fund the commission here. There are estimated hundreds of thousands of children in Oregon that are suffering because they're not allowed access to one parent or the other. There are
tons of anecdotal evidence and countless statistics that draw correlations between fatherlessness and all the social ills we have out there. And it was in recognition of these facts that the funding for the PAVE project was allocated. The local project is not without merit, and I am impressed with the sincerity of Dan, Peter Zach, and others. But to the trained eye, it is all too apparent that the program was designed to fail, whether intentionally or not. Number one, our concerns as advocates with the programs was that the input wasn't solicited from any of the local fathers and non-custodial parents advocates. We basically showed up largely uninvited to the meeting when they held it. I forget the date, I believe it was in April of 1998. When the four of us advocates showed up for the initial meeting, we were asked for and gave our input. All of our suggestions were ignored. The one that was discussed, statewide 800 number in order to, among other things, help document the extent of the program, was liked by most, but it seemed to be killed by the objections of this one individual there. All of the fathers and non-custodial parents advocates objected to the grant being administered in Douglas County by the courts for a number of reasons. Number one, Douglas County is not a good demographic representation of Oregon. Number two, we didn't like federal funds being spent on a state mandated project. Number three, it was a program that was already in place and funded. And number four, the administration of this project through the courts is futile because the courts, if they're not the source of the problem, are at least perceived as being the source of the problem by non-custodial parents. There's a pronounced lack of interest and participation in the project, and that demonstrates, at least to me, that people don't feel comfortable that the courts are going to or able to do anything about the problem. We also fear that mediation would be overused as a tool of enforcement, and it is. Mediation is a tool to negotiate a parenting plan. Once the parenting plan is a court order and becomes violated, needs to be enforced, not renegotiated. Wave one of the pilot projects, as well as other studies, have shown that mediation intervention as an enforcement tool actually makes things worse. And understandably so. If an angry custodial parent is bent on destroying their ex's relationship with the kids or kid, and they've done so with impunity in the past, then there's really no reason for them to not do it again. The small mountain of paperwork has made easier access to the courts by the pro se or unrepresented litigants. And in a few short years, they might fully understand the process, if they can read, that is, but of course that's another story. Advocates and our groups need to be deeply involved in this process of family law reform before any real change is possible. The governor had his commission on family law, and it seemed to do very little. That's why we're back here this legislative session. And we understand the problems that non-custodial parents are facing from an intimate standpoint. We're all non-custodial parents, and we've all dealt with these problems firsthand. We've heard the problems echoed time and time again by many, many people, men and women both. It's the same problem over and over again. And when it comes to visitation enforcement, courts are not enforcing visitation right now. Certainly not with anywhere near the zeal that they enforce the child support provisions of divorce affiliation decree. And, of course, the children are the silent victims. They're the ones that aren't being represented. So advocates are used to operating in shoestring budgets. You can stretch a buck quite a ways. If we were allowed to form this commission, we could, from the sanctuary of the state government, access resources that otherwise we could not, further enhancing our ability to effectively treat this problem. And we could, from the sanctuary of the state government, draw outside funding that the existing program doesn't even opt for. We have a volunteer base that is very educated, motivated, and devoted. High conflict divorces where parental alienation is practiced have been shown to resist conventional remedies, and many studies show that. And as any psychologist will tell you, it's insane to continuously approach the same problem with the same solution and expect different results each time. We can't force a person to be a good parent, but we can allow them the opportunity to do so. And also, please remember that when parenting time is enforced, child support collection is increased and relitigation of these matters is greatly decreased. And that's basically all I have to say. I'd be glad to answer any questions anyone may have. Questions, Kurt? Kurt, and could you describe a little bit about what the Douglas County program is actually doing down there?
Well, they have made access to the courts easier. There's a considerable stack of forms and papers there. I've been involved in these issues for a long time, and it's still, the whole process eludes me quite often. And for a newcomer into the situation, just looking at it would be very intimidating, and trying to understand the scope and magnitude of the problem. There was a young man at a meeting last June down there in Westford, came in and was asking questions. He was interested. He was probably in his early 20s. He wanted to find out about how to get his visitation enforced out so he could see his child. And the young man couldn't even read. He couldn't read the pamphlet in his hand. And so that pretty much makes that small amount of paperwork pretty insurmountable obstacle there. Most of the money down there is being spent on administrative functions. There is considerable use being given to mediation as an enforcement tool at times. And mediation, of course, is not an enforcement tool. Like I say, I believe that the people that are involved in the project, for the most part, are well-meaning, but they're not quite as motivated as we are, and they don't understand the problem from the standpoint that we do. And so I see the program as being basically a lot of window dressing, you know, a way to waste an awful lot of good money that we could, you know, even though it's only $113,000, and that's a small amount of money, that we could stretch that. We could put an awful lot of that money. Yeah, because it's good. I hope that answered your question.
If I may, Mr. Chair, there may be some fears. There's very active gender politics going on in the state. It's unfortunate, but it is a fact of life. Oregon Men's Association does not wish to contribute to gender politics. The mothers and fathers need to both be involved in their children's life, and there may be some fears that this commission is maybe a back door to funding a father's rights agenda, if anybody can really ever identify what exactly a father's rights agenda is besides just seeing their kids. I'm going to read from just a little bit of the federal law exactly what the intent of the law is. To establish and administer programs to support and facilitate non-custodial parents' access to and visitation of their children by means of activities including mediation, both voluntary and mandatory, counseling, education, development of parenting plans, visitation enforcement including monitoring, supervision, and neutral drop-off and pickup, and development of guidelines for visitation and alternative custody arrangements. That's what the commission is going to exist for. It's going to do something about taking care of this huge problem we've got in this state. As legislators, I'm going to, most legislators to talk to, get calls from people who say, I'm paying child support, but I don't get to see my kids. What am I going to do? Where do you have to send them? Do you have nowhere to send them? This commission will be part of the state government. It'll be someplace where you can send them, that can make appropriate referrals, do appropriate education, help set policy. That's basically what it's here for. It's going to use federal money, not state money. It's a win-win situation for everybody.
Kurt, you've given us some added information of access denial surveys and some things like that. You might spend a moment or two here kind of bringing us up to date. And Lane, would you have be able to have that law? I don't see it in any. Did I overlook it in some of the things that you've offered us here? If not, could we have a copy of what you had there to pass out to the committee members?
I only have one copy here. I'll be happy to
make sure. We can get it copied right now and pass out if you think so.
Thank you.
Okay, sure.
In the evaluations of the Wave 1 and Wave 2 of the pilot projects that led up to the criminal access and visitation enforcement grant, this is a Wave 3, apparently. In the evaluations of Wave 1 and Wave 2, it was found that from the standpoint of non-custodial parents, there was a little change in the situation. After mediation, there have been in those evaluations and in another of other evaluations of similar projects, it has been found that in, well, in, as written by Ira Daniel Churkat, PhD, and this was, I believe, an excerpt from a book by Pearson and Anholt. And it found that about half the cases that were exercising some sort of periodic visitation compared to cases exercising no or rare visitation became worse following PARC's program participation. Thus, it appears not only that such programs are highly ineffective, but also that just participation can actually place a family at risk of a more serious problem, that's quote. As I say, the evaluations of Wave 1 and 2 found the same thing as shown on the chart in my exhibits here. There's some question as to whether those charts are exactly correct. But if you read the notes there, it says shaded should be switched. Well, even if you switch that, it still shows that in certain cases, access to children became worse after participating in these programs. And then there was the study, the survey of 400 divorced fathers from Grant, Howard, Marion, and Tippecanoe counties in Indiana. Each father in the survey had been denied access to one or more of his children on five or more occasions during the year 1986. The survey was conducted in 1987 by the Indiana Fathers Network. Found that 76.9% stated that the problem of access denial became more frequent after going to court on the issue. Now, the concept here is a pretty easy one to understand. If you go to court, if you're taken to court on what is called here in Oregon contempt light, and that's what it's referred to when you are in contempt of the court order regarding the parenting plan provisions of that court order, and you are not given any punishment when you are found guilty of committing that contempt light, then you're very encouraged to go ahead and commit that act again. There are a lot of reasons why people deny access to the non-custodial parent of the children. But an awful lot of those reasons have to do with just the personal animosity between the two people, and that's very common in divorce. If someone is really bent on keeping the children away from the non-custodial parent, then there's nothing there to stop them at all, and they realize that, they end up in court and they just get that reaffirmed that there's no way to stop them from doing that. And in some of these programs, mediation interventions are found to actually encourage that behavior because they're seeing that there is no punishment there for denying the parenting time to the non-custodial parent.
Yes.
I just want to say that my heart really goes out to the non-custodial parents, especially the fathers that are trying to be responsible and trying to do the right thing. There is a bill in judiciary called Covenant Marriage that I hope, because I'm listening to all this, trying to find a solution, and it's voluntary, but if you get married in a covenant marriage, you have to agree to counseling before you get married, and you have to agree to counseling before you get divorced, to read all these statistics and show what divorce does to children, and how if you have to get divorced, how you need to keep your kids, number one. And some of the ministers in Corvallis are doing this already, and one at the college said that first three people that he agreed to after counseling, two of them decided they weren't ready to get married, and one didn't, so we count that as a success. But we do need to do something because of how divorce, you know, just tears apart the kids and the mom and dad. And if you need a commission, I certainly support what you're asking, because I know some of the frustration, and there are dads that don't fly off the handle, even with your setbacks, because I've worked with you for 3 years. I know that you've been, you're decent people, and you deserve, you know, the right you're after.
Thank you, Senator Chairman.
Thank you. I'd also like to point out, if I could, there is currently nowhere at all for fathers or non-custodial parents with these kind of problems to go anywhere in the federal, state, municipal, or county jurisdictions. All the government monies that are being spent, there's nowhere for anyone to go with these problems.
I have some folks that have traveled a little distance to get here. Larry Redler and is it Dennis? Didn't he? I'm sorry.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Larry Redler, and I live in Medford, Oregon. And I don't have a formal prepared statement, but I have the experience. I've been there. And like Senator Shannon was talking about, I'll try to keep it brief. But I am a truck driver and was returning home to Medford when in a conversation with Oregon Men's Association Director Mr. Barlow, he informed me of this hearing on Senate Bill 1097 this morning. Like I say, I don't have a formal prepared statement, but I'd like to share my thoughts. Fathers are being denied an active role in the nurturing and care of their dependent children. The present paradigm emphasizes the father's role as financial support, but denies his active participation in a loving, caring relationship with his children. And I'll give you two examples of it. When this divorce started out, I had a successful business for 25 years, and my ex, on the advice of her attorney, took $11,000 out of my company checking account, which deep-sixed me, then she was got a restraining order where there was no hearing or anything, just she was fearful for her life. Well, I can assure you that most people would be fearful for their life if they had taken a lot less money than that. So this was the weekend. I have five children, and I have twin girls whose birthday was May 18th. And I had been out of town, and I had gave money to my older daughter to take them to get them something for their birthday. And when I came back on May 26th, I was playing ball with the girls, and my son, well, the ranges in age were from 4.5 to 14. And I was down at the local school playing ball with a tennis ball, so none of them would get hurt. And along comes my ex with this restraining order and the police department, and had me arrested for violating my restraining order. And I submit to you, one of the obstacles to this parenting is the restraining order, when implemented with visitation, constitutes entrapment. I would also like to submit, this is my son also, who was having difficulty in school learning, very frustrated, and manifested itself in anger, and it seems that the anger is taken out at the closest person to them. And I thought, you know, this is kind of like having a pet that turned on you, and I thought, not that he's a dog, but I use that as an analogy, and I got to thinking, something's really wrong here. So there was a Dr. Winkleman who was on a local talk show, and his expertise is in attention deficit disorder and dyslexia. And he was going to have a presentation at the Smullen Center, and I encouraged my son's, my ex-wife and my son to go to this, and we all went there and was really moved by it. And so Dr. Winkleman was going to be there the next day, and he said that anybody who wanted to be tested could be tested, and so I left the money to have my son tested, which was $195. Come to find out, he did have dyslexia. He did have attention deficit disorder. And I got him on a nutraceutical product, and within 30 days, his mother told me how this boy had changed around. And today, this boy, with the exception of his foreign language student, has got a B-plus average, who before never exceeded a C. And I say that you must not have artificial visitation of, which I call getting reacquainted, 2 weekends a month. It must be active. You watch, you see this. Two parents have a better vantage point from watching a child than one does. And I feel really proud that I was able to help my son on it. He's very vivacious now. He's happy. He has a sense of humor. We got along really well, and I think it's really helped our relationship. I mean, he found out that all the stories he heard from my ex, Dad was there when he needed him. And I'd just like to, hopefully the commission will address this ongoing problems. I've never met Mr. Jagger, but I mean, I was really impressed, and Mr. Barlow has been just indispensable in helping me along the way. And I urge you to support Senate Bill 1097. I believe everybody wins.
Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, I've submitted a sheet, if you've got it. My name is Dan Dennehy. I'm a co-director of the Oregon Men's Association. Spent a lot of years dealing with this problem personally and with members of my community, Multnomah County, Portland, Oregon, the greater Portland area. I'll tell you right off the bat, I don't have any formal degrees in any psychology or licensed therapists or anything else. I drive a truck for a living, and I do my best with my children. But the state imposes hurdles that, Larry put it very well, causes an artificial atmosphere when we are allowed to quote-unquote visit with our children. And it makes it, as Larry said earlier, was reacquainting yourself with your kid every time you're allowed, quote-unquote, by the state to see your children. This puts an onus on everybody's shoulders, but especially the children. This is a lose-lose situation that we have as a status quo. Nobody wins. The state pays large amounts of money to chase this rabbit around the track. The primary and utmost reason there's a need for the conception of this committee or commission is, quote-unquote, the best interest of the children. A subjective phrase, but one that conjures up images of happy and healthy and well-rounded kids, something rational parents everywhere hope for. The present system, whether by design or outcome, in far too many cases, disassociates children from their fathers and, in more cases, alienates the affections between father and children completely. In a large number of cases, due to the adversarial and biased support structure, children quickly lose faith in both parents. Most fathers are responsible, proud parents, praying to be beneficial and integral influences in their children's lives. Far too often in a failing marriage and subsequent divorce, dad is thwarted in his attempts to continue his influence in his children's life by the overpowering and far-reaching mechanism. In any case, we collectively have engineered a recipe for destruction, and the children lose. For more than a quarter of a century, we've had a system that is literally blind to the destructive nature of the, quote, men are abusers and women are victims and survivors, unquote, mentality. These are words straight out of the Multnomah County Domestic Violence Task Force handbook. This is the idiom that has been the primer for our Oregon law legislation, Oregon family law legislation. The people that comprise this particular panel are judges, parole and probation officers, mental health workers, county officers, and cadres. Panels and groups such as these have heretofore written and implemented the family law legislation this great state has run its family court system with. Albeit this panel, one of many throughout the state, has members with impressive titles, they do not speak for all members, nor even the majority of their respective professional communities. Senators, axioms such as this are destructive and bigoted premises that are the status quo. These are the presumptive condition used as a compass to guide us through the labyrinth of the dissolution of marriage and the beginning of new family circumstances. The added, sometimes insurmountable hurdles put in place by courts and peripheral agencies because of tenets such as the one above are unnecessary impediments in an already strained process of instilling security and solid foundations in our children and raising them to their fullest potential, dominant aims of most parents, I believe. Fatherhood in this great state and the 49 others has been looked at with a skewed eye for as long as I can remember, and mothers have been entitled to a position of primary parent without much question. Ergo, fathers have been routinely given the ominous task of navigating the abyss of unfriendly agencies and programs, not to mention a legal web, while doing their best for their children. In fact, all data indicate the absence of the biological father in children's lives is the predominant indicator for at-risk children. Children without contact with their fathers are those most likely to commit suicide, experience contact with the legal system, be involved with illicit drugs, drop out of school, and become teen parents. All of the abhorrent behavior parents fear for their children are most likely to occur with children alienated from or completely separated from their biological fathers. We as a state must do more to support our young men and women in their quest to establish themselves as parents, productive citizens, and role models for the up-and-coming generations and society at large. As it now stands, any divergence from the ideal of stable and intact family, the father is the first to be held in scrutiny and suspicion. He is the one to be outcast and sequestered into a position of visitor in his children's lives. As cited in State v. Dirk, on and on, among others, the Child Stealing Statute, ORS 163.640, is concerned with the right of the parent to the custody of the child, so that stealing the child is a primary offense against the parent. The state clearly recognizes the inherent right of parents to protection from undue and unwarranted influence from outside the home. Although this particular case was concerned with a non-family member interfering with a parent's right, the trauma and ultimate consequences are just as devastating when the perpetrator is an ex-wife. Unfortunately, in our great state of Oregon, as with the entire nation, the definition of family does not include fathers when programs are implemented and services are handed out. As can be seen from this image, there is not a father in sight. Yet I got this image from the Administration of Children and Families World Wide Web homepage while I was looking for studies on children. And if you'll see the image on the page. In my hunt for the information, I was entertained with an announcement that the ACF, the Administration of Children and Families, has implemented a program to, quote-unquote, educate fathers of their significance in their children's lives, complete with tens of thousands of TV, radio, and printed press PSAs announcing the aforementioned statistics that children are much more, by majority percentile, likely to become at-risk children without their biological father's presence in their lives. It is ironic and indicative, Senators, that given the ACF's newfound knowledge, they have taken no steps to alleviate the obvious exclusion or omission of fathers in their introductory homepage. Senator, these are facts that ORMAN, the Oregon Men's Association, has been pronouncing since our inception some 6 years ago. ORMAN is an association consisting of intelligent, including a PhD and sundry other lettered persons, but mostly non-college educated people who have occupations outside the political arena. The hours, days, and years spent living in, studying, and trying to understand the effects of and the reasoning for the offensive legislation and enactments have brought us to the following conclusions. There is indeed a crisis of fatherlessness in our society. The reasons for and the causes of this issue are many-faceted, but one facet that can be eliminated, is to remedy the state's adversarial and overwhelmingly biased procedures. A commission for fathers and families working to pave a less traumatic path for all involved would be an invaluable asset to Oregon's children and families. Children not only need their fathers but they have an intrinsic and inalienable right to that most basic and fundamental condition. The examples of omissions and ignorance such as the ones above are innumerable. The destruction and trauma caused by programs and legislation enacted because of this ignorance have plagued this generation for too long. With the passage of this bill, SB 1097, this great state has the opportunity to again be a forerunner and example for others on recognizing past infringements and being stalwart enough to immediately set out to remedy the damage done. The proposal before you today is a step to alleviate the oversights and transgressions of the Departments of Health and Human Services, the Departments of Human Resources, the courts and like agencies, public and private. It is a commission such as the Commission for Families and Fathers and Families, comprising intelligent people with education and life experiences involving the atrocious conditions I speak of, that can begin rectifying the intolerable conditions and educating the respective agencies of facts and situations they have evidently been ignorant of for the past 30 years or more to better serve the public. The commission, by no means a panacea, is an overdue step towards resolving a dichotomy that constrains us all, but puts the children of this great state in a disadvantageous position. The obvious and most desirous condition is one of which families never find their way into the family courts, and our work towards that condition should never cease. Short of that ideal, a system dedicated to maintaining, continuing, and unfettered contact between parents and their children is the most beneficial and necessary legal and social goal. The creation of the Commission for Families and Fathers is the means to better strive for those goals. 80 to 90% of all non-custodial parents are fathers, and this is an unacceptable condition. The Commission for Families and Fathers would indeed aid in eliminating the state's unreasonable interference and barriers in a parent's right to continuous and frequent contact with their children. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for your time and consideration. We pray that you understand these are not imagined nor exaggerated conditions. The enumerated symptoms and conditions and remedies are indeed real. The prompt and expedient implementation of this commission would put us that much closer to a solution of the quandary that plagues us all, namely generations of contented, well-adjusted, and peaceable citizens. Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciated, Miss. You also gave us this kind of case history of,
and that, if you look, Mr. Chairman, on the second page, I think is identifier of the submitter of that. He could not be here today. I picked up his testimony and brought it down. It's Dr. Tim Criswell, PhD.
Okay. We will enter that into the testimony.
Thank you very much.
They have called a caucus. Unfortunately, our session kind of takes precedent here. What I would like to do, we don't have time to act on this today. We have members of the Department of Justice and also of the AFS and Oregon Law Center that wish to speak. David, how long is your testimony?
My testimony will be very short.
All right, why don't we take care of yours, and if I could ask Sandy and Kevin and Linnell to come back when we hold a further hearing, I would certainly appreciate that consideration. I'm sorry to cause you this. I was hoping that we had a few more minutes that we could get this done. Go ahead and I'll add with my apologies here, and I'll set it out and play some music with my majority leader here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Niebel. I work for the Oregon Law Center. I will be very brief. There's no question that there is a problem with parenting time enforcement in the state, as the previous witnesses have described, my concerns basically had to do with the fact that there are ongoing programs that I think are worthwhile in Douglas County and also in Marion County to provide direct services to parents who are two non-custodial parents to try to facilitate their access to their children that would be defunded under this bill. I would also just mention that there are two bills in Ways and Means, Senate Bills 82 and 60, that have to do with making it easier for lay people to get access to the courts. And that would include non-custodial parents who want to file their own parenting time enforcement, parenting plan enforcement action. Those have a fiscal price tag of, I think it's $2.8 million. They're in Ways and Means now, having come down from the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that's the extent of my testimony.
What I'd like to do is to instruct those interested in this bill that we will have a further hearing and the potential work session on this bill. I'd like to direct staff to find out exactly how much the federal money is coming available to the state and how much of those are actually going to on-the-ground programs and possibly if we could find out how much are going to administrative processes and that kind of thing so that we could have a little more definitive. But I also would like to have you contact the Douglas County at the moment.
I think it's Marion County, Senator Fisher.
And contact those programs and perhaps just some type of a communication from those folks exactly what they're doing and if that money is truly being used as it's proposed that it should be. And have that available as you reschedule another hearing. And I'd like to thank the gentleman for hope your truck is not sitting out here somehow with a $10 parking ticket on it.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you all for coming today and time on this. And anyone that wishes to work with staff or has some information they'd like to have available and ready for the next session, staff will be available to have that ready for us. And thank you all for coming today. Close the public hearing on SB 1097 and close the session, Senate Health and Human Services.